He half thinks I'm kidding. Yeah, it is really.
Mosquito brain?
Correct. Direct translation.
Yeah. That's pretty
That's
interesting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Ready to go?
I'm ready.
Andy?
Yeah, sorry.
5 more minutes to text.
No. Just 30 seconds. Sorry. Good.
Welcome back to another Barnes Bullets podcast. I'm your host, Dale Evans. Today, we've got a guest. It's our, I think this is the first time that we've had a real guest on the podcast.
Yeah, the inaugural.
The inaugural podcast with a guest. So this should be exciting.
Yeah.
So we've got Andy to my right. We've got Greg Sloan to my left and Ryan Muckenhern.
Nailed it.
Did I get it?
Yes. Smoked it.
From Vortex.
Here we are.
And you are in-house, which is kind of cool to have you out here in Utah instead of in the Midwest. You guys are out of Wisconsin, correct?
Correct, yep. South Central Wisconsin.
Yeah. Yep. What brings you to Utah?
Barnes Bullets, honestly. So I'm on a phase 1 of 3 adventure here where I'm hunting all the native species of grouse and quail in the lower 48.
That's cool.
And so I'm in southwestern Utah, Wyoming tomorrow is opener.
Okay.
Sage grouse, dusky grouse. And then I'm scooting over to South Dakota and I'm going to pick up prairie chicken and sharp tail grouse. So it's like 3 hours and I could not come to the,
Yeah. You are here on a Friday, which kind of stinks because you weren't able to see it going in full operation, but you got the tour.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts? You said that you've been to a couple other ammo facilities before, but.
My biggest thing for folks just tuning into this, or if you're just curious about Barnes, I've been attached to some sort of manufacturing now for about 16 or 17 years.
Yeah.
16 years. And when I walk into a machine shop or when I walk into a facility, small or large scale, to see intimacy, the size of what you guys got going on and how much control you can have.
Yeah.
And then being like a rabid user and consumer of your products, I understand why I get single digit SDs. You know? And I'm not joking.
Yeah.
I load like 34 metallic cartridges. And if I can find a factory solution, that saves me time and money. And the amount of, especially Vortex and Vortex LR that I shoot now in lieu of my own hand loaded ammo, because I don't know that I can load to that level of quality. And when I come in here and I walk around and I see the shop floor and I see custom machines and I see process checks along the way that are extraordinarily detailed, I get it. I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have a 300 yard indoor range.
That's always fun.
Yeah. And like the people must know.
Yeah.
So I understand.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I've never really thought about that, but Greg and I were hand loading some 280 Ackley yesterday and today. And we were getting, we were trying different powders and all this, and some powders we were getting like 20 for SDs.
Yeah.
So to think that we have this, you know, loaded ammo, literally box shelf ammo, like you said, that does get that low SDs. I never really thought about that, that it's like, literally our factory ammo that you can buy anywhere off the shelf has lower SDs that can do better than I can do hand loading if you don't have the proper powder. Yeah. We got it figured out and we ended up getting down to, what was it, like 4?
Yeah.
6?
Yeah, you had like a couple of 5-shot groups that were both single digit. You were 4 SDs, 5 SDs.
Yeah, super cool.
Yeah, which obviously there's other variables, right? I mean, it's not just...
Right.
Oh, just, the gun, just, the chamber, right, the bore. Right.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
But it's capable.
Yep.
The control's there. And I think you did bring up a cool point because even myself, you know, I've been in this industry for quite a while now. And so obviously I'm aware of it and what we do here in our processes and our capability. Mm-hmm. But I think it is interesting. There's kind of this idea that if I'm hand loading, I'm building a superior product.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, and I understand it to a point, but I don't think everyone always factors in and fully understands what goes into premium ammunition on the quality control side, the development side, how much effort and measurements go into making sure you have an entirely reliable and robust round. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that we measure and we worry about, you wouldn't even think about as a hand loader. You know, so I could come out specific angles and say, in a lot of different factors, you're probably getting a subpar product by hand loading.
Yeah.
You know, you're not factoring in everything. You're not doing all the steps. You don't have all the tools. You don't have all the equipment to be able to reach that level of performance when done properly that some of this loaded ammunition can accomplish.
Yeah. It is crazy how good it has been for me. And then for, you know, a lot of the folks I run in circles with, you know, I used to hand load for guys because it was convenient for them and I enjoy hand loading. And now it's like, no, you can just buy it in the box. And they do. And it's the same result everybody I talk to. And I just love it. And then now with Harvest too, having that offering, the feedback that I've been hearing from friends of mine or customers of mutual customers of ours, they've just been over the moon and ecstatic about it. So, what is happening here is pretty special. So it's exciting. I'm honored to be here too, by the way. I forgot to say that right off the bat, but, it was cool walking the shop floor, seeing that.
No, we're happy to have you. I've been looking forward to it. I know we were kind of exchanging some emails. Yeah. I don't even remember where it started, but I
wanted intel on white-tailed ptarmigan.
That's it. There you go.
Yeah. Yep. There was a discussion of pack goats.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, you might know where who else got involved.
But. Mitchell swears that there's these ptarmigan in Utah. And
They're there.
Yeah.
If you want to go put on 25, 30 miles of hiking around at 11,000 feet to find them.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like trying to chase rainbow trout in Wyoming. Like you have to do like a 15-mile thing. And maybe you would. What?
Not
rainbow trout, golden trout.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, golden trail. That's what I meant. Sorry. Yeah,
it's a 14-mile infill to this spot.
I mean, you could do 25 miles for a rainbow.
You could.
Yeah. Don't need to.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's where it started. We were kind of exchanged some emails. Yeah. I pulled Mitchell in. He shared some intel of some spots to go in Utah. He had some experience where he'd kind of targeted them himself without success.
Yeah.
But yeah, it started and we kind of went back and forth with, hey, you're going to be in this area. You know, you did definitely make the trip down here, which we appreciate, but we're excited that it worked out and you can come down here and be on site.
Nope, it's super cool. Super cool.
We're excited. I mean, your podcast, right? I think it's safe to say it's something we aspire like to be, right? And have the following and the engagement and all that stuff. So when we heard that there was an opportunity to have you on, we were like, absolutely. Yeah. And it makes all the sense for you to be the first guest that's on it.
Yeah, for sure. Especially as much as, I mean, you know, Greg's been on there a few times. Obviously, it's a big podcast that gets listened to around our facility and everything. So, yeah, I go with that. Like, it makes a lot of sense for you to be our inaugural guest. And with that, I mean, this is kind of the first time that I get to, I guess, interview somebody because I feel like it's always just been people that I talk to on a regular basis anyway. Right. But I would love to know about Ryan, like where you came from, like how you got into the industry and kind of give us a little brief backstory.
Yeah. So I have a tendency to talk a lot, so feel free to give me the hand signal.
That's fine. Apparently people love, we're not going to do your 10-minute talks that actually only go like 45 minutes. Apparently our audience says that they want long form content. So you are more than welcome for it.
So a little bit about me. I'm from Minnesota originally, central Minnesota, little farming community. My introduction to guns was my grandfather. At the age of five, the indoctrination began. Put a 1911 in my hands, a 38 Special J frame, a Ruger 10/22, and we just shot and shot and shot. And he was a gun guy through and through, but he was as much of a gun guy that like a Korean War vet that then also had a job and a family could have. So he, like, very utilitarian guns, not like eclectic or anything like that. And he got me crazy about bullets pretty early on. And in trying to inspire safety or educate on safety, on like capabilities of cartridges, he would take a Yellow Pages book and he would duct tape it shut. Mm-hmm. And then we would shoot into it with different calibers and we would count the pages that a particular projectile would penetrate to.
Yeah.
And then we would look at deformation and things like this. And he's explaining like hollow point versus, you know, round nose versus solids, et cetera. And he got me my first reloading press. I can't remember if I was like 12 or 13 for Christmas. And I was mortified of it. And because I was like, I'm manufacturing explosives in my basement, right? and it took me like probably an honest year to 2 years to actually pull the handle on the thing the first time. The first cartridge I loaded was .223 Remington. And then it just like snowballed. Then I thought I was going to make money by loading my ammo, like I'm gonna shoot coyotes and I'm gonna like sell the hides and this is gonna become a business enterprise and then I'm gonna retire by the time I'm 20, 22, somewhere in there. Turns out you just buy more reloading presses and tools. And then fast forward a few years at 15, like I was obsessed with guns, the history of guns, their mechanisms, their lineages, et cetera. And there's a gun shop in my hometown, Little Crow Shooting Sports, still there. 18482B202 Circle Street in Hutchinson. and I would ride my bike there or I'd get on the wrong bus from school so that I would get dropped off near there and I would walk there.
It's awesome.
And I'd go like just walk the racks and like learn about stuff. And the owner, and this was unbeknownst to me at the time, my father moved to Hutchinson in 1983 and started with this electrical contracting outfit that had a sports shop. And the sports shop sold guns. And the guy who ran the counter was the owner of this gun shop. And he put my dad up for like 3 years until he and my mom got married. And so he knew my dad when my dad was like a punk. And he knew who I was like right away. And eventually he's like, hey, why don't you just come here every day after school? And I was like, okay. And like I got to unload 1,000 cases of Winchester Super Targets from the back of a semi. That was like my first, it was 1,088 cases. It was my first assignment, and worked there for like 7 years. Hmm. And so slinging guns, selling ammo, mounting a lot of scopes. And that was like my true baptism into the industry, I suppose. And then I got picked up by a class 3, class 7 manufacturer, also in my hometown. And we also had like a, we'll call it a retail division sort of, where we would make products outside of our like law enforcement and military and then civilian contracts for like 3-gun, especially magazine tube extensions for shotguns and like little widgets, gadgets, lickies and chewies that you would, you know, hang on your AR or your shotgun or whatever. And did that for like 4.5 years. And then I was a competitive shooter, shot all around the country for multi-gun and USPSA. And about a year and a half into that gig, I was at SHOT Show. And my accountant's like, hey, you're going to carry this brand, Vortex. Nobody had heard of Vortex. This is like 2011. And I'm like, what? And so he sends me down, me and my boss down to the show floor. And we go meet now 4 of my coworkers. And they give me the elevator pitch on the brand. And I love telling this story. I was like, I was 22. And I'm like, yeah, respectfully, no. Like, I've never heard of you guys. Like what you're saying is crazy, you know, like, and I declined, and my accountant's like, well, too bad, you're gonna like figure it out. And did like 4 or 6 months of market research on the company and read every manual, watched every video on YouTube, was on every forum back when forums were the things, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, these guys really got it figured out. Ended up picking them up and integrating them into our line, and we sold the snot out of Vortex Optics. Kept shooting. And eventually I got an email from our VP, said, hey, if you're ever in the area, swing by. And I was like, I'll let you know if I'm in South Central Wisconsin. He's like, hey, how's next Tuesday? And then that was 1 of 4 interviews. And now I've been there for 11 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So September 8 was 11 years.
That's cool.
Yeah. Don't shoot competitively anymore. Now I just put all my focus on hunting, mostly Western state stuff. Still hand load quite a bit. Love doing it. I think I'm up to 7 presses now. And still love guns. I've never grown tired of this industry. So it's been now, I think, 21. I think I'll be 22 years in February that I've been doing guns. And I've still never shown up for a day of work. So, yeah, it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
I dig it.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Yeah, that's a really cool story.
Yeah.
And for the youngsters out there who don't know what Yellow Pages are, yeah, right? It's an old school phone book, right? Yeah. Like the dial phone or like one landline. Yeah. But no, I mean, talk a little bit about too, like, you obviously have a strong affinity for Barnes. Like, yeah. I think you're not shy about that, which
no.
I love, but where did that come from?
Sure.
When did you start with Barnes? You know,
one white-tailed doe, 4-town Minnesota, 1 .243 Winchester and 1 not Barnes bullet.
Okay.
And, you know, there used to be this thing when I was younger. So this is like a 16 or 17 where when people were talking about like what kills a critter, it was energy. Energy is what kills it. 7 rem mag. If you're not shooting, you know, energy, you're not coming to the table with a dead critter. And so I was going to get a 7 rem mag, and I don't really know why, but I did have a 243. And so the only way I could get energy is by increasing velocity. And so I picked an off-shelf offering, and I'm not going to mention it here. Super users could probably deduce what it was, but it was a very light for caliber projectile that offered a lot of energy. And I started thinking, I was actually reading books on African big game hunting, and they were talking about anchoring shots and shooting for skeletal structure. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to track things. I want to break them down. Mm-hmm. And if I break both scapulas and likely sever the spine, that whatever I shoot is going to drop right there. And so I targeted a scapular shot on this white-tailed doe at a relatively close distance with this light 6-millimeter projectile, and encountered what I later learned was called a flap injury, where the bullet effectively grenades just subdermal when it hits bone. Thankfully, some jacket material punched the pleural lining and deflated along. I ended up recovering this deer, but it was atrocious. And I said, there's a better way to do this. And so by that time, I'd started hand loading. I started buying bullets. And some don't, they're not even in existence anymore. And the first one that I fell into was the MRX.
Yeah.
And I haven't been home in a while, but if I raid my reloading room down in my parents' basements, I'm sure I have a couple of those things left. Or if I look around, I probably have some loaded 308 MRX ammo. And I ended a whitetail because I'd started reading about barns and started buying load manuals. And you see the pictures, you know, and I'm like, God, I really want one of them bullets. I ended a whitetail, very large body. This is northern Minnesota, like not terribly far from the Canadian border. So they grow them pretty thick up there. Mm. And so like frontal shot, just below the white patch of the throat, exited out the rear ham, and then went through like a 2.5-3 inch diameter poplar tree behind it.
Wow.
Never caught the bullet. And that thing folded like a $5 tent. And then I recreationally study anatomy. And so like I do a lot of kind of low-level necropsies on things that I shoot. And I'm looking at the like the pathway through this thing. And I'm thinking about other things that I've shot and like how bullets behave when they encounter that medium. And this is different. It's very different. And I'm like, wow, this is wild. It's like you put a ninja bullet blender at 2,700 feet per second through this thing. And then I started reading more on projectile design and then understanding how energy works and how energy doesn't work. And then a light bulb clicked. It's like, oh, if I can maintain 95% of my mass while I'm traversing a body cavity, I'm not shedding mass, ergo losing energy at an exponential rate, I'm actually doing better. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. Then I just hooked up on it. And now I've stopped counting the number of critters that I've shot with TSXs, LRXs, TTSXs. I shot varmint grenades for a long time when I was still hunting hides. Very effective bullet. Not great for penetration, but that was ideal. It's my go-to. Here and there, I'll use other bullets if I'm curious about how things work or what they'll do. But if I'm hunting, and if I'm like being very honest, like I travel a lot to hunt, I'm not a super wealthy guy. And if it's like the opportunity that I have on a game animal and I'm 1,000 miles, I'm 1400 miles from home right now, I'm hunting birds. So it's a little bit different, but you know, I've got an elk hunt in Idaho in October, and it's a 29-hour drive, and I'm bringing one gun, and I'm probably going to have one opportunity. And I can't dictate that opportunity is necessarily a broadside shot. I might have a hard quartering away. I might have a frontal. And like my thought is I want to deliver payload to target without hesitation or question. And this is the bullet that has done that for me so routinely. I'm talking dozens and dozens and dozens ahead of game that I've killed over the past 2 decades. And people I know that I'll call them converts, if you will, or that I've loaded for, we've all experienced the same result. Like target your exits. That's what I do with barns is where if I don't have a broadside shot, I target my exits and, they just pile drive whatever I shoot. And it's a bullet that I've come to trust. And I talk about that a lot on our podcast too. Rifles you can trust, optics you can trust, and bullets you can trust. So that's the last thing I think about when I'm in the field. You know, if it's that one opportunity on day 6, hour 11, you know, what do we do? Well, we've got a bullet that we can trust and put it on and lay it down.
Nice.
Yeah.
One of the things that you talked about, and you talked about it early on there, right, is talking about trying to put down an animal in its tracks, right? Yeah. And you didn't want to track. Like, what made you want to do that? Because I think we've talked about it on a podcast before, right? Like, I always feel like I've always been a shoulder shooter, mm-hmm. because I don't like to track animals. So I'm originally from the southeast, like in northeast Florida, southeast Georgia, like that type of area, right? Swampy, thick. It's like you don't want to track an animal because if it gets 100 yards, you might lose it because it's water or something like that. So what made you kind of want to become a quote shoulder shooter?
Sure. Two parts. Environment was a big one. So in that part of the state, north northwestern Minnesota is also a swamp.
Yeah.
So a lot of tamarack, spruces, and then sawgrass. And, you know, we didn't wear like western boots when we were going out to our deer stand. We wore rubber boots.
Yeah.
Because it's just wet. And, you know, if a whitetail lays down in 4 foot tall sawgrass, like,
right,
you either have to have a blood trail or you got to just stumble upon it,
right,
to find it. And then two, the really curious part is I don't particularly like killing things. And so, to lay it down right then and there, then that part's over and that part's over pretty quick. And it just, you know, it's a more honorable or prideful thing, I think, maybe, to be able to do that. Cause nobody likes taking a follow-up shot.
Right.
It happens. Like we're all kidding ourselves. If we say it'll never happen, it'll always happen. So I wanted a bullet that could absolutely, as close to certainty, guarantee that what I shoot is anchored,
yep,
right then and there. And I can count on one hand the number of times that I've had animals take a step. I think my furthest recovery with a Barnes is about 60 yards.
Okay.
And it was a very long shot on the outside of the, the function window of the bullet. And it was also after I had shot a whitetail 11 minutes prior in that same spot. So, I've got a lot of theories on why things run when they get hit. One of them is just condition of a target alertness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, that was actually the most external hemorrhaging I've ever had on a game animal. So that was a very easy follow up. Just walked down a big red carpet and picked her up. But yeah.
So my next question about the things we were talking about, and I'm sure other guys got questions as well. So hang tight.
Yes.
You were talking about, you know, rifles, scopes, and bullets are the three things that you can kind of always rely on, right?
Yeah.
If you know that it's going to do it. Why do you think people, and maybe we're getting way deep really early on, but why do you think that people always want to buy the most expensive rifle, most expensive optic, and then go cheap on their ammo when the ammo and the bullet is the only thing that touches the animal?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that in the U.S., we've been conditioned, and maybe not just the U.S., but globally, we've been conditioned to think that like money always buys you the best. And sometimes that's the case, right? But like if we audit our product line, like I can sell you a $149 rifle scope. And I know guys that go to Africa and go kill 30, 40 head of plains game with them. I know guys that have taken doll sheep and stone sheep with Crossfire 2 rifle scopes, and they're $150.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's like a risky proposition. But then like with ammo specifically, I think a lot of this also then comes from upbringing and culture. So in my neck of the woods, and this has diminished quite a bit now because younger people are doing different things, but we had like hunt camps and like everybody shot a Remington 760 or a Winchester Model 70 or a 94 or a BAR. And, you know, Uncle Paul, he had a 270. He was kind of out there a little bit. we all shot .06s. And then everybody shot, you know, brand X, Y, or Z's soft point. And it had to be 180s because 180s were better than 165s. And I think a lot of that, if you're not a really dialed gun or bullet guy, gets lost.
Yeah.
Like the ammunition can sometimes become an aside in the thought process, but only because so-and-so before me said it was better. And then when I think about ammunition and bullets and ballistics especially, and I mean, I've been in the industry now for a long time. Greg, you can attest to this. It's pretty recent that all of a sudden this is like open source information that anybody can get. You know, I can remember my first PRS match. This would have been 2014. Data was not wildly published and widely available. Like it was like you knew a guy who had a 260 and happened to shoot 123 Sennars, and he could give you some data.
Right.
And then you could chronograph it and you could extrapolate it. And like ballistics calculators weren't a thing. And social media wasn't a thing. And, you know, these YouTubers and websites that are doing independent ballistics tests weren't really a thing. And so it's new too. So the information that consumers have to them now, I think is going to change that. And I think people are going to start understanding more about what is actually touching the animal, how it works, and what is that mechanism that actually kills the animal. because it's not something that's really been talked about for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, not that long ago, 20 years ago, the talk of the town was these super high speed, semi-frangible projectiles as being the deadliest things in the woods. You want that thing to dump all its energy on target. And you know what bullet I'm talking about.
Yep.
And I mean, you can talk to, any number of elk guides and they'll tell you, no, we don't allow those in the camp. And it's not a fault of the bullet. It's just the wrong bullet and application, but it's like tribal knowledge that kept getting passed down and like the wrong magazine article written about what works and what doesn't. And I think that's where a lot of that comes from. I see it changing though. Like the feedback that I get from our podcast, cause we talk about bullets more than we talk about optics.
Yeah.
The feedback that I get is people are like waking up to it and they're understanding now, that is vitally important. Like that makes or breaks the hunt. So can your rifle, so can your optic, but like that is the last thing that leaves your barrel on its journey to success.
Right.
And so people are, I think they're catching up.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, my turn.
Sure.
Okay. Mine's a selfish question.
Yeah.
You're going on an elk hunt
pretty in typical. October.
Yeah. Totally typical. What are you using?
Vortex LR 190s out of my 300 Win Mag.
Okay. Okay.
So this is cool. I had that rifle put together, from the former Remington custom shop for my dad. Cause he decided to retire it was kind of a false retirement. He's not going to listen to this. He doesn't know how the internet works. So, he had a false retirement. And so he got onto an elk hunt and my dad is not a hunter. He's like every decade or so he'll wander around the woods with a rifle. And so I outfitted him top to bottom, new outerwear, packs, knives, bullets, boots, backpacks, the whole thing. And so I had him this 700 built in 300 Win Mag, and immediately just bought Vortex LR and 300 Win Mag. And the barrel was handpicked by a good buddy of mine that used to work up there. Now he's at Mack Brothers. And so it's a match grade 5R, and it's a fast barrel. Like it's unusually fast. And this is not an early lot of LR, but like they were moving out of that gun at like 2960. And I'm like, wow, that's moving. And this was before I was into the suppressor game. And so I had that gun chopped like 2.5 inches about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago. I was like, I wonder how much I'll give up. And so I had some newer lots of that and I'm still at 2850. And I think Box posted as 2880 on that load. And I was with a couple of guys from our marketing department. One of them just is finishing his elk hunt right now, is successful with it. And he's a bow guy, not a gun guy. And I said, we're changing this. We're getting you into a gun guy. I'm going to show you how turrets work. We're going to talk about chronographs, the whole nine yards. And so we've got a 1,050 yard range. And I do the hastiest zero I've done in a long time with this rifle. Shot it over my Garmin. I got 5 rounds of data, single digit SDs, dialed my 600 yard coordinate and laid down a 4-inch group, 3 shot on a hot barrel. And I'm like, what? This is why I don't load 300 Win Mag because like I don't have to.
Yeah.
And so I ended up ordering, I think 4 or 5 more boxes. I just actually were delivered this week. So I'm going to go check those and see how different they are than the lot that I have, but that's what I'm running and all the confidence in the world in it too. So that's a monster bullet.
Yeah,
that is a monster bullet, and it shoots so well out of that gun. And I'm confident with that one to actually 7. So 7 will be my, I hope for like a 71 yard shot, but
yeah,
7 will be my max envelope on that.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
And you said that you haven't, when we were talking earlier, you said you have 2 elk hunts this year.
I do. Yeah. The other one, well, you're the first to know about it, but, we'll be hunting in Montana with the 300 Super Wisdom.
Nice.
Yeah. So, it's funny. I do this a lot on our podcast. Like I put together something just for the podcast and then it like either lives at work or it lives in my safe and never gets used again. Well, so we threw together that first 300 Super Wisdom and can we call it that? Can we call it Super Wisdom?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's what we've been all calling right. it.
And the rifle's nuts. I mean, it's like an honest, everybody talks about like, that's like a 30-minute gun. But what that means is like most of the time you shoot a few groups and they might measure around a half. Like what, if you did 100 groups and then you like measured it, you could come up with what that gun is actually probably statistically capable of. But this thing is obscene, how well it shoots. And, it's a work gun. And, you know, my podcast co-host Mark just kind of adopted it. And so now it's like Mark's gun. And not really. I mean, but I never built one for myself. And so when we're in discussions about this, they're like, well, what are you going to shoot? You guys going to share a rifle? I'm like, I got a share rifle. I'm going to build one. And so I ordered an action. What day is it? Today's Friday. I ordered an action on Wednesday. So it'll be there when I get back. I've got a barrel under my desk and I don't have a stock or a trigger yet, but we'll make that up as we go. And hopefully I have that thing built by about November 1 and
awesome.
And then data down range after that. But yeah, so we're going to go shoot
that. What action did you go with for this build?
Mac Brothers Element.
Perfect.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I just finished putting together a 7PRC off an Element. Yeah. Macros.
Unbelievable action.
Awesome.
$1,000 action. It's 19.9 ounces.
Yep.
Nitrided through and through. Everything's steel except for the cocking piece is titanium, but not even the cocking, the shroud. Beautiful action. Really fell in love with that. For a builder action, there is no better value on the market.
No, I agree. I'm super excited to do another one off.
Yeah.
Well, you're taking notes, right? Because you don't have a 300 of all people.
I know.
The fact that you don't have this gun, I feel like it should be illegal.
It's probably true. We talked a little bit about this, and I know I've told the story before, but my when the lab first messed with this 212 bore rider, you know, the 300 Super Wisdom is an awesome name, and that's the one we go with. But we kind of nicknamed it the poor man's 300 Norma when we started messing with the 300 Wisdom case as a, you know, vehicle, a way to launch this 212 bore rider on a long action, obviously, with a 1-8 twist barrel. But at the time, I had a 338 Lapua rifle, and it was like, well, I can just build a 300 Norma. And so that's the route I went. So I shoot the 212 bore rider, but out of a 300 Norma.
Yeah.
And I actually do need to build a 300 Super Wisdom for multiple reasons. But, you know, we even mentioned this a little bit, like you're burning a lot more powder.
Yeah.
And you're not getting a big return. I mean, what are you getting out of your 300 Super Wisdom 212? You're
28, 25.
Right. 28, 25. I mean, I think I'm like 29, 25, 29, 50, depending on the load. But, and I don't remember the exact charge off my head, but I'm probably 15 grains more powder.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know? It is a model of efficiency. But its capability is just bananas. Like how that thing eats wind and when it hits target too, like we've done 945 is the furthest gel that we poked, 50 inches of penetration. We had full expansion at 20 millimeters of depth into the block. And it's like, what is going on with this? And like, it's going to kind of be my everything rifle because it's not going to be heavy. You know, it'll scope at about 8 pounds, scoped and canned. And there's nothing you can't kill with it. And it's also not undue from a recoil perspective because it's not that stout of a charge.
Right.
Like it's in the upper 60s. And if anybody loads 300 Wisdom, you know, depending on what powder you're running, you can run handily into the 70s with conventional projectiles. And it's a very pleasant recoil sequence too. And I'm assuming that has to do with like just the bearing surface of the bullet being as abbreviated as it is compared to a full, you know, shank on a lot of other bullet designs. Super pleasant to shoot. It's torquey. I can feel it.
It is.
Like you can feel an 8 twist and you can feel a bullet that long. But it's pretty neat. Several guys at work could build them. The builder that put together our gun, I think the first day he had 15 calls. When we launched that podcast on whatever this is, I need it. And the number of Instagram DMs and Facebook DMs and emails that I get to my work, like, what's the load data? And now it's like, you don't have to. You can just buy it.
Yeah.
And their jaws just hit the floor. Like, guys are super excited about that.
Yeah. Well, every time you guys talk about it, right? Yeah. Our sales go, whoop.
Good.
So, like, if we could schedule, like, a weekly thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be fantastic. Yeah,
talk about it. Or just give us a week heads up so we can, like, restock a little bit.
Yeah.
Because every time they talk about it, we sell out.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. Hopefully here soon, we're going to be loading more. I got some shells on the way and we'll be loading more 300.
Yeah. I think that about the time that this launches, I think we should be like 3 days out from it being relaunched. So if you're listening.
Ooh. Yeah, but
it's a scary proposition to put time on that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can also just move this around as we need it. That's
fair. And, you know, more on that cartridge, it's not that big of a deal to configure the gun with it. When we had started that project, there was not a reliable way to get a Tika to do it. And now there is. Mm-hmm. And like that is probably the most economical way to do this. If you're thinking about building a 300 Wisdom with a 212 spec, you just need an eight twist tube. And then you need an unknown munitions, extended magazine and bottom metal.
Yeah.
Bolted together. And then if you don't already have a long action, you need an extended bolt stop too, but that's a $30 part. And so not an invasive procedure. There's not a whole bunch of, you know, you're talking about your 300 wasn't built and you're opening up feed rails and you're modifying port diameters and lengths. And this is a barrel and two bolts and a pin.
Yeah. I was going to ask like for the listeners who don't have this, like this is not something you can pick up off the shelf, right? The firearms, like what does it cost if somebody wanted to go shoot this?
Sure. So if I was going to like napkin math this out and I was going to using the Tika T3X as the base platform. So if you don't already have a T3X, they're all the same. So whether you buy a Rough Tech at $1,400 or a T3X Lite at $600, it's the same action. You're going to need a Magnum bolt face. So, you know, 300 Win Mag, 7 Rem Mag, you could use a Wisdom as a starting point. I recommend getting a 300 Win Mag or 7 Rem Mag so that you have the action length right off the bat. The unknown munitions kit will be just under $300 for the magazine and the bottom metal and a barrel, which if you get a hold of like Preferred Barrels, you get a hold of like Dylan over there and you say, hey, I want an 8 twist, 30 caliber blank, 22 to 24 inch, or you do it in 20s. I've talked to guys now that have built 18s on these and they're still getting, you know, low to mid 27s.
Yeah.
And like, I know what happens at 2,600 feet per second with this cartridge, with another little project that we're working on. You breach 2,700 feet per second. The viability is nuts. But Dylan can spin you up a pre-fit Tika barrel, 8 twist, Sammy 300 Wisdom chamber. That's the other beautiful part too. There's no custom throating going on. You know, you don't have to worry about freebore and you don't have to worry about lead. It's a Sammy 300 Wisdom chamber. Right. And he'll do a pre-fit 300 Wisdom. You're $765 into that. So you have your gun, whatever cost, if you already have it, or, you know, on the low end, probably about $600 for that. And then probably about a G to get the barrel and magazine components. And then you're functional.
Yeah.
So you're 1500, 1750 into it.
And you can go all out on the stock and now you're going to be above two, but you can get into it.
Yeah. You can go as crazy as you want. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But like $1,500 rifle to shoot this is not astronomical.
No.
Right.
No, because there's a lot of factory guns that are $1,500.
Yeah.
And we use Tikas a lot at work. Most of my test guns are Tikas, just because they're such a reliable system. And then we change the barrels and the actions are so true. And the pre-fit options out there are so good that like we burn down a barrel. So we use two identical 6.5 Creedmoors that we just alternate so that we get some life out of them. And my team doesn't shoot that much, but you know, we probably burn a barrel every 12 months. And then I just got pre-fit barrels on reserve, just rip the barrel off, put a new one on and life is good. You don't have to futz around with head spacing or goofy stuff like that. And you're just ready to be operational again. We can do it in the garage, but, really good vehicle to use it on, with that magazine out there, feeding and function is flawless. You can also use a Remington 700, you know, long action, start with a Magnum again, so that your internal box is correct and your feed rails are correct.
Right.
Otherwise you're going to be doing a little, Geppetto work in the machine shop. I know guys that have done them on Savages now, and a Winchester Model 70 of all things, but, that was a concerted effort. That was a lot of goofing around. And then builder actions too. You know, if you want to do this on, you know, like what I'm doing in Element Action and using Hawkins Precision Bottle Metal, like this is all pretty high end stuff, but I'm trying to build a pretty specific rifle.
Right.
I would have done a Tika if the magazine would have existed at the time that we started that project. So
yeah, the Tika builds are actually pretty interesting. I mean, I'm definitely familiar with the gun, the platform. We use them, you know, we have every rifle manufacturer in the safe, right? We have Tikas as well as everything else, but I'd never personally done a build off a Tika until about a year ago. Mm-hmm. I put together a 6mm Creedmoor for my brother as like a Predator rifle. And he purchased a Tika T3X in 308. I ripped the barrel off. He bought a Macmillan. I think it's the Game Warden or Game Scout, whatever the short action. And then he got I think it was a Carbon 6 pre-fit carbon barrel. I slapped it all together, you know, with our Precision Match 112 ammo. It's shooting literally half MOA all day long. And I was like, all right, here you go. Done.
Yep.
You know, bolt some stuff together.
And yeah.
It's pretty cool.
They're an awesome platform to work off of.
Yeah. I was kind of curious with that prefit, cause I've messed with a few prefits before. You know, I've done some Remington stuff. Yep. I've done, you know, prefits off Savages with a barrel nut, you know, setting headspace. And so I was kind of interested to see how it headspace. And so, I mean, when I threw the barrel on, I grabbed gauges and checked, and I'm like, that's spot on.
Right on. Yeah.
You wouldn't mess with it.
And it's an economy rifle right. in the scheme of rifles that are out there. When you get into like the collet type barrel nut guns, like the Savages or Ruger Americans or, you know, Mossberg ATRs and things like that, you're going to save a little more money because they don't have to worry about shouldering a barrel.
Right.
So they just thread the shank and then you use the collet, and that's fine too. Like I've done a couple guns like that. I prefer a shouldered barrel. Almost just more aesthetic than anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't need to necessarily look at that big barrel nut on there, and then I don't have to relief cut a stock. And
yep.
Yeah. No, Tika is a good way to go. That is, I think, the very, very keen and economical route to do that. But sky's the limit.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to.
Yeah, you can go.
Oh, yeah.
You can go way high.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, like, back to, like, you saying you're surprised I don't have one. It's on the list.
Yeah.
It about 10 others, right?
Yeah.
But I will say I've had a few people reach out. I know I talked to people at the shows this past year with the 212 success, you know, and interest because of the Vortex Nation podcast and story with the ultimate long range hunting rifle, all that. You know, I had guys, they want to like rethink it, you know, they're mm-hmm. like, that's awesome. And they're intrigued, but it's like, but what if I took a 7 PRC and necked it up to 30 counts? Like, I don't think you're going to gain anything.
No, I mocked one of those up. Cause one of my guys, we call him Magnum, cause he likes big stuff. And so he bought his little Magnum, which is a 7 PRC, big 28 nozzler guy. He's like, I think this would be a really good case candidate for it. And I don't disagree with that. Like 7 PRC is a really intelligently designed case. And so I just went down and threw a 30 caliber expander mandrel and a die and ran it out and then did a little case study. And I think you get about a grain to a grain five more H2O capacity, out of the 7 PRC. But I think that depending on whose brass I was measuring with 300 Wisdom, like I could also change that as well.
Yeah.
And I don't, like, I think it would be a brass availability thing that would move you into the 37 PRC Wildcat. Mm-hmm. Cause there's probably more readily available 7 PRC brass. We're very fortunate. We use 300 Wisdom for, recoil profile analysis at work. So I think, you know, to the tune of about 60,000 pieces a year. So we have, these big bins that I can Scrooge McDuck dive into at work. So I have an unlimited supply of 300 Wisdom brass,
yeah.
Which works out pretty good. And again, I think 300 Wisdom is a very, very balanced case from a design perspective. It's a very strong case. Longevity is outstanding compared to a lot of other 30 caliber Magnums. Like 300 Weatherby, I get two loads on and then I lose my primer pockets.
Right.
Like they're toast. And, it's a good cartridge. I think a 37 PRC is also cool, but probably unnecessary steps for marginal gain
yeah. for sure. I actually did the exact same thing you just went through, and that's exactly where I came up. It's about a grain and a half, and it was like, you look at propellants and where you're going to be with charge and velocity, and you know, I bring that up because the 300 Norma build I did, it's absolutely not worth it. I mean, I already had the gun, I already had the receiver, that Magnum bolt face, you know, that large Lapua bolt face, and if you knew what I went through to modify my action and stock after the fact with machine work to get a Wyatt's extended box to fit two rounds.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is not the route to go.
Yeah.
And in the end, what am I gaining? 100 feet per second. Yeah. But if you look at the, like you said, it's efficiency. Mm-hmm. That 300 Wisdom with the 212 is all about efficiency. You don't have to launch at 3000 feet per second. No. You don't have to launch at 2900. Like you even brought up the 2700 mark. You start to look at the downrange. Yeah. You know, I mean, I talked a little bit with Dale about this. You know, if you're I'm going to shoot out to 400 or 500 yards.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue all day long why the 300 Super Wisdom with the 212 probably isn't needed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not. But you go 500 yards past, and you've proven this we've talked about your other project.
Yeah.
I don't want to steal your thunder there and talk about it.
No, we talk about it. Like, it's, if you want.
Yeah, bring it up.
308 Winchester launching the 212.
Yeah.
And so I was bored one night, and I was on the Hodgson Reloading Data Center website just looking at stuff because, like, this is my entertainment. And I was like, oh, I wonder what the heaviest bullet they catalog published load data for in 308 Winchester is. And it's 215 Burger. And like, that's a long bullet. It's a big bullet and it's got monster bearing surface. And so I'm like doing redneck pressure analysis in my head and I'm looking at their COAL at 2.810 and I'm like, oh yeah, no, they're not afraid of pressure in this. And I'm looking and like, they're shooting that bullet at Sammy COAL at 26. I'm like, oh yeah, I can get a 212 LRX going 26 out of a 308 without even trying. And so I thought, okay, am I going to go a small pocket brass for a little more integrity? And nope, I just went with Once Fired Hornady from the range bucket, literally. Dug through the, I went down to the lab. So we've got a lab at work, a reloading lab, and dug through the bucket, found a bunch of Hornady brass, ran it through the universal decap die and worked up a load in a very inappropriate gun in a Kimber Mountain Ascent, by the way.
Perfect.
So 10 twist barrel, so they didn't gyroscopically stabilize. In fact, they tumble so quickly that depending on when they tumble, your chronograph will pick them up in the tumbled form,
right,
and you'll get a misread on your MVs. But was able to hit that window with a modest charge of Farragut.
Yeah.
And I had some, we did a kind of an introduction podcast on that. And a gentleman reached out, he put together an 18-inch gun on that as well. And he's into the 26s with it, safe data, no pressure signs. And again, there's something magic about that bullet, and somebody smarter than me is going to have to explain it. But I'm assuming it has to do with bearing surface. It doesn't develop pressure like I see conventional ogive bullets do it, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can get away with a little bit more. And you're also not eking into the case capacity as you would with other longer bullets, like that Burger example that I used. And when you look at like a 300 Wisdom and a 308, and you look at like the case mouth to shoulder, like case mouth, neck, shoulder junction, they're pretty similar in size. So the bullet presents very similarly to the powder column in the 308 as it does in the 300 Wisdom. And when you run the numbers on that, you want to talk about efficiency. Like I'm into the 40s for powder in the 308. I'm into the 60s with the 300 Wisdom. There's a 230 foot per second delta there. And that's not insignificant. Like that does translate downrange to trajectory advantage, energy advantage, MV retention advantage. But I set it next to my 300 Win Mag with the 190s, which is a slippery bullet. And it's not an undue, you know, cartridge from a charge weight standpoint. And that 308, once you get past 400 yards, eclipses the 190, 300 in performance. And at 1,000 yards, not that I'm going to shoot 1,000 yards, I'm not, 300 foot per second advantage, 308, 300 foot pounds advantage, 308.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's wild.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Those ones are fun to look at.
Yeah.
No, and you're exactly on target with the advantages of the bore rider design on both parts with the case capacity and with the bearing surface difference of that. It's pretty cool.
Oh yeah. I'm excited for that one. That's another one of those things where I open my mouth on the podcast and then Mark's like, hey, you now you have to build it. And so I have a donor Tika action.
What barrel length do you think you can go with on that?
22. Yep. 22. I'm going to go with a lighter contoured carbon wrap barrel. So not, you know, typically you see like a Sendero or a Sendero light as your typical profile, but my builder does custom carbon wrapping. And he does like a number four contour wrapped. And the carbon is just aesthetic at that point. We're not getting any structural advantage, but oh, is that gorgeous? Even a number five, they're not super chunky. And I want that gun light because that is going to be an everything anywhere gun. So I love 308 Winchester. It's one of my favorite cartridges and super versatile. And this is just taking it to a completely different level. Not and here again, you're talking about shot distances too. People are enamored, I see by and large, by figures like BC numbers.
Yeah.
And they like them tall and they like muzzle velocity. And like criticisms I get as a you know, very vocal supporter of Barnes is like, well, their BCs are so low. I'm like, well, relative to what? Yeah. Like match profile heavy for caliber projectiles. That aren't necessarily appropriate for shooting big game, unless you're at like extraordinary distances where we need to lose velocity so that we have some integrity to the projectile. Like if that's what you're looking for, that's probably a better thing. But if you audit like how far you typically shoot things, and like my hunting partner and I have done this, he's 59 years old. So he's a bit older than I am. And he's hunted all over the West. He's hunted Africa. And we were driving to Wyoming one year and we were going through like all of the critters that we killed. And the number is staggering, and our average engagement distance is 255 yards. Mm-hmm. And like, we both have extreme outliers on that, right? But that's not typically what happens. Like, I think of on the mule deer and pronghorn hunts that I've done, like trying to find a 500 or 600 plus yard shot opportunity, like you have to find it.
Yeah.
You have to be pursuant of it, and not my personal style. Like I'm not really interested in trying to do that. A lot can happen in 500 yards, especially on crazy terrain. So yeah, the BC thing, how did I get on that tangent? Where was I going with that? Oh yeah. Is the 212 LRX and a 308 worth it for every 308 shooter? No, probably not. Right. But it is a thing where I could hunt a 308 now comfortably to 600-700 yards and not even think twice about it.
Yeah.
Just with what that cartridge and bullet combination is going to deliver on target. I mean, it's
yeah.
wild.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to jump in. And with that, right, like with that 212, like you have so much energy and velocity yeah. at those distances. Now you can make a 308 like a very viable moose cartridge, yeah. right? At 500-600 yards, yeah. which is crazy to think about when there's a lot of people that are shooting 338s yeah. for yeah. moose, right? Yeah. To get to that.
Yeah, and I think, like, I know you're a fan of the 130 grain mm-hmm. TTSX in a 308 Winchester.
Yeah.
And you could very well argue, like, if you're not going to shoot past 300 yards, you know, you said 250 yards is kind of yeah. that average right in there. And I totally agree. Even with open country, we like to tell ourselves yeah. we're probably going to encounter these really far shots. And they're possible, but sure. in reality is, yeah, they're, the average is probably 250, 300 yards. That 130 grain TTSX traveling at 3125, give or take, at the muzzle, you know, flatter shooting, you know, it's going to impact at higher velocity. The bullet's going to expand. You're going to have great performance as well. Now, obviously, your wind's going to be a different story, yeah. even at 300-400 yards with that 212. But you're right. It all of a sudden opens up a whole other envelope of possible oh. engagement distances.
Yeah.
On the BC thing, I do want to address that a little bit. I think you do bring up a good point. And I've seen this a couple times, so I just wanted to quickly mention it. I do find it sometimes entertaining, if nothing else, yeah. where you'll read things, you hear things, yeah. oh, the barns aren't as high as BC. Well, when you're comparing a TSX flat base to a VLD style bullet or yep. any other match projectile, yeah, you're right, they're not. But go look at the LRX mm-hmm. and even some TTSXs compared to a hunting tipped lead core bullet.
Mm-hmm.
They're very competitive.
Yeah. And you know, something to be cognizant of if you're like shopping and you're thinking like, what is my best foot forward? Understanding where BC actually gives you an advantage, like where it actually matters. And I suppose it depends on who you talk to, but it's probably 500, 600 yards plus where yeah. you start to see what a profile that's measured in a G1 in the, you know, 0.6 category versus a 0.4 category. So the pretty big disparity there, like 500-600 yards, and then you kind of start to see it. But if you practice enough and you're not shooting in 10 mile an hour, 90 degree or 270 degree winds, you can accommodate for that, like a lot, like the 130, TTSX loading that you're talking about in 308, it's probably the round I shoot the most at the most things. Mostly cause it's a bullet that I trust and then out of a rifle that I trust. And, it's like its own cartridge. It's different. It's a 308, but it's like different than regular 308. And I've pushed that one to, I gotta think, 435 or 432, full pass through, full expansion, DRT, like impacted on the shoulder, broke both scapulas, dead right there.
Yeah.
And, you're right. I mean, wind kind of eats its lunch, but it's not a terrible BC. I think it's a 0.350
right.
G1. And that's not terrible. I shoot 45-70 at 500 meters. That's terrible. That's like a 0.2.
Yep.
So yeah, no, it's pretty interesting how, and a good way you put it is like entertaining, to get tied up in knots over the value of that figure. And it is important, but it's not the most important thing. And then its relevancy just is completely applicational. Like, are you shooting 600 plus yards? Then I think it matters. Then you look at a different solution, right? And a lot of your guys' bullets, like you're not really marketing them to be a 600 plus yard solution, right?
Correct.
And there are examples in your line that certainly are capable of that, but that's not the bread and butter of what these things are designed to do. So yeah, don't get too hung up on BC. Yeah.
One of the things that I kind of want to talk about is, you know, with our 212 bore rider, right? Like, it's kind of interesting or wild to me just how much, obviously, you guys had a big impact to make that quickly sell out, not only in our reserve ammo, but also, I mean, just like having component bullets.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you think that your audience or you know, people out there are wanting more bore riders, and where do you see, you know, potential things fitting in?
I just feel like this is such a loaded question. Like, it's like, we're going to expand the bore rider line. That's where you're
going. I'm not trying to go there. I'm trying to ask him.
Yeah.
And kind of ask the audience, what are you looking for?
Yeah. The answer is yes.
Well, I mean, for example, right? Like, let's just say that people have been, I've read the comments, I've seen the comments on social media, on YouTube, blah, 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 right? Man, we really want one of these for a 7 PRC. What a lot of people don't understand is just how quick of a barrel you would need to be able to push that type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, as you know, I kind of preface all of that as like, it then becomes pretty wild. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of barrel manufacturers that are making a 1-in-6 284 barrel right now.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
No.
Right. But again, I mean, like, there's a lot of things that have to start aligning to be able to make all of these things happen.
Talk about some interesting, like, evolution in rifle craft. So not that long ago, like a 9.25 or a 10 twist was a not uncommon 7mm twist rate. And now 7.5s, 7.75s, 8s, like, is the standard.
Right.
And that happened effectively overnight. And we're seeing this now in quarter bores too. So quarter bores were all but dead 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, quarter bores they're the new thing.
Yeah.
And they're going to be really talked about here probably in a couple of months. But so I got to tip my hat to Kevin Brittingham from Q for a 1-in-3 twist. And not just for a really cool cartridge in 8.6 black, but for what I call opening the third eye of terminal ballistics, where we understand that energy and velocity are a critical component to this. We're now understanding more as a user base that projectile technology, whether it's composition or engineering and, you know, the nose cavity or all these things, is also very critical. But then there's this other layer to this chest, and that's like rotational energy.
Yeah.
And like what it does. And when you pair it with a bullet like a Barnes that has integrity and it doesn't lose its shape or its mass, and you have these 3 to 5 blades that radiate out from the side, what that does inside of things as you increase twist rate is spectacular. And so it was neat to see a cartridge like 8.6 black, which is really niche, like as niche as they come, catch on as quickly as it did. Or, I mean, it did. There's manufacturers that are chambering 8.6 black with a 3 twist or a 5 twist. And it's not that the barrel manufacturers don't have the capability to do it. They've just never had the call.
Yeah.
And so is it conceivable that a projectile comes to market that requires a 6 twist, where conventionally it was a 7.5, 7.75, or an 8? Like, how big of an undertaking is that? Technically, it's not. I mean, right, from like a manufacturing perspective, it's a new writing in the program, and then that's that.
Yeah.
It's just new, and it's weird.
Yeah.
For now.
I do have to jump in and say a couple things. One, without giving too much away, we are messing with things. We've already kind of alluded to that a little bit. I have a 6 twist, 7mm barrel in the lab. It won't be a 7 PRC though.
Okay.
There's other factors, and you brought up a good point. You know, look at 6.8 Western. You know, we've seen a million times where we brought out 6.8 Western in reserve with the 155, and we still see comments where it's like, I want 170 grain.
Give me heavier. Give me heavier.
Yeah. You can't. It won't fit. It won't stabilize in a copper projectile.
Right.
You know, and if we look at other bore riders, there's going to be those situations where we have to configure a specific one. The 300 Wisdom, the case was chosen for a reason. You're going to have similar scenarios with the 7mm version. And faster twist rates, longer actions, shorter cases, so that the overall length as a cartridge can fit in mag feed. I mean, there's all these other things to consider.
Right.
And then...
Well, and I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at, right? Yeah. Is like, do you think that the average consumer is thinking about all of those things rather than just being like, I just want a bore rider in a sudden...
No, they're not. They're not. Absolutely.
I agree with Greg. One thing is like the mass thing you talk a lot about, like, when I start having the conversation about your guys' projectiles with customers, because like one thing that I'm super fortunate at work to have is like, so my regular day job is not podcasting. It's picking up a phone and answering.
It's not?
No.
Oh. Yeah.
Right. It's pick up a phone and answering emails. And, but we don't have scripts. We don't have time limits on our calls. And our leadership says like, hey, if you're in a conversation with somebody and you realize that you're an SME in the field that they're looking to get into, subject matter expert, you know, and this guy or gal's going on their first pronghorn hunt, and like I've killed 18 of them, I should be able to speak fairly fluently to how to do it from the everything perspective, like what boots do I wear, you know, what knife do I carry, what rifle do I shoot.
Yeah.
Talk to them about that, because otherwise they're going to have to go to like 15 different resources and get 30 different inputs and try to make decisions. Well, here's what I use. So I talk about bullets a lot on the phone.
Yeah.
And there's still a big disconnect in understanding of what mass in a projectile affords you or what it's useful for. And like, I turn the clock back 25 years in my life. My understanding, you know, a quarter century ago was that, well, if the bullet weighed more, it killed better because it had more power because it was, you know, heavier. And that can sometimes be completely the opposite of truth, right? With a copper projectile like a Barnes, sometimes it's advantageous to be less. And compare it to a bullet, like I often make the comparison, like in 308s, when I recommend the 130 TTSX, a lot of people are a little gun shy. They're like, man, that's pretty light. Well, that 130 TTSX is about the same length as your standard 150 cup and core. But then what's better? A projectile that impacts at a higher velocity but maintains about 98% of its integrity or a projectile that impacts slower but loses 40 to 50% of its integrity. And they sit and they think about that a little bit. And I'm like, so if you recover both, one of them weighs exactly about the same as it launched. The other one is 40 to 50% less than its fired mass. And it penetrated less and it touched less things that allowed that thing to die quicker. In this case, like, to Craig's point, there's a function problem with making a heavyweight copper projectile. There's also not an express need.
Yeah.
Yeah. From like a terminal performance standpoint. And it just happened that I think the 308 variant, like that was a Goldilocks diameter, that the length and the mass was great and the BC is nuts, you know. There really isn't a need though to go to a 170, 277. You know, that 155 is like the pocket. But you're trying to, I think, reverse a lot of conventional thought processes where people have been accustomed to that higher mass meaning something without maybe understanding fully, you know, material properties of copper. And then, like, you get away with less mass and often to an advantage, like with velocity. So, yeah, I would say for folks thinking about that, like, don't get too hung up on super heavyweight projectiles just being the answer themselves. There's way more than just mass in the equation. And often it works to your detriment. So I'm excited to hear that you guys are goofing around though.
Yeah. Andy was giving me like, stop talking. So I'm like, I'll back up, but,
we'll see. Right. I mean, I think it's all a process. I mean, it's gotta make business sense. Right.
Right?
And so, there's a lot more to discuss.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll see where the future goes.
Okay. I do have to back up real quick. This is going to switch gears, but you brought up an awesome talking point with the 8.6 blackout.
Yeah.
So we worked quite a bit early on through an OEM customer,
yeah.
Gorilla Ammunition loads on one of our 338 225 grain TTSXs. Might be the TSX, they might do both. We've done work with both, but anyways, it was interesting because when they first approached us about this projectile, you know, I understood obviously rotational velocity is going to change, mm-hmm. the function characteristics of the projectile. But having said that, when you look at the function window of this 225 grain as is, this was designed for a 338 Win Mag and that function velocity window. And so, you know, 1 in 10 twist. So I understood that there could be a performance gain, but I didn't fully understand how drastic it was going to be. And so when they first approached it, I was kind of like, I still think we're going to want to tweak this function window. You know, we're all on board with building the bullets, but it was like, I think we're going to have to build them a special version, drop the function velocity, change the internal cavity, get it to function bigger at a lower velocity of the 8.6 blackout cartridge. And they're like, no, we've already been doing some field testing. This is what we're seeing. And I was kind of like, let's see. And so at the time, I didn't have a barrel in a 1 in 3 twist. So I couldn't go run out to the lab and just go prove to myself. But I did have a 1 in 5 twist, 30 cal. And so I actually took a 168 TTSX and we went out and shot different functions. We're very familiar with what that bullet does, obviously, at across the velocity range. But we took a 1 in 10 twist, 30 cal, shot the 168 TTSX into jail at a given velocity. And then we shot it out of that 1 in 5 twist. And the bullets more or less looked the same. We shot multiple shots. You know, it wasn't a substantial gain in expanded diameter going from a 1 in 10 twist to 1 in 5 twist. Now you could argue there was slight differences, but it was more or less the same.
Yep.
But when we finally got the 1 in 3 twist, 338 and for the 8.6, and we got a barrel, dies, brass, and we started loading 8.6, and I shot the 338, 225 out of the 1 in 3 twist. Sure enough, that thing fully expands out of the 1 in 3 versus obviously the 1 in 10 that it was designed for at much lower launch velocity out of that 8.6 blackout. It's impressive.
Yeah. And you know, more on like on cartridges and selections, as Greg was alluding to, it's not just a bullet that you can stuff in a case. Right. And so like when we put that, the initial video out, you know, folks would call and they'd say like, well, my 300 PRC is launching, you know, a 225 at a higher MV anyway. I'm like, I understand that. And they're like, well, can I put it in the 300 PRC? I'm like, well, you can, but you're going to kind of, everything's going to change. Like there's a lot more to just, taking a bullet and putting it in a case and making it work. And you're going to have to kind of get yourself into a thought process where you're examining the cartridge dimensions, the case dimensions, as much as you are the bullet dimensions to make a really intelligent pairing, with, let's say, a 7mm projectile. And it probably isn't going to be a 7 PRC just on case overall length.
Right.
Yeah. And I get that. And, cause otherwise the rework on the rifle is just going to be nuts.
Yeah.
Or you're going to be single feeding and nobody really wants to do that.
Again, you didn't hear this, but I have to, one little word, 7 SOM. May or may not have a fast twist 7 SOM in the lab right now.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You know, and it is a shame that 7 Wisdom, is there a brass option for 7 Wisdom right now?
Very, very little. I haven't dug super deep on 7 Wisdom right now. But there is good 7 SOM brass available, and the case dimensions are pretty.
There's great 7 SOM brass available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have a question too. Just talking about Greg, you know, spilling all the beans.
Sorry,
and
you can edit this.
And messing up and messing around, and Dale screwing with his headset. He's having all kinds of problems. Dude, over here.
I have no idea. Like, I literally went to adjust it, and this thing just like popped. And I was like, okay,
cool. It just kept getting worse, man. Yeah.
Like, the people listening, everything's just falling apart.
The people listening won't know, but if you're watching the YouTube video,
well, I was just happy that you guys were just talking, and I'm just over there like,
So you don't have to worry, Andy, because nobody was listening to what I just said and spilled the beans.
The great thing is that, like, no, it's good because everything was going that way. So that's why we do two camera angles.
Yeah. It's Friday afternoon and we're on the struggle bus here. Exactly. At Barnes. But you know, one thing I always look at is like, what is the industry or whether it's Barnes or whether it's, you know, the broader ammo industry, like what are we missing? What is the consumer asking for? You know, cause like, when you did the podcast right on the Vortex Nation, like what, 2 weeks ago or whatever it was, we go through and we read all the comments, right? Mm-hmm. And a little plug, I think a lot of the comments that people made and requesting, like 2026 is gonna be a really good year for them, right? Mm-hmm. So you can go through and read the comments and deduce what you want. But outside of that, like what are you hearing? What are consumers asking for? And what problems are they having that we need to solve?
It's a great question. The pendulum swings, if we're going to speak specifically to cartridge, the pendulum swings with a pretty predictable like undulation. Mm-hmm. It seems like every 5 to 7 years we change our minds on whether we want a hyper efficient vehicle or a completely overboard system. And so like we had John Lazzaroni on a few months ago. And so like John represents the hyper overboard side of that. At the same time, he also did a short mag, but he did it like 3 years too early.
Yep.
And then it died. And then the short mags came out and people were nuts about them. But then cartridges like the Nozzlers come out, 26, 28, 30, 33. And people were crazy about those. And then that went away. And then we went into these micro format cartridges. I got guys calling me, asking me what bullet I would use for mule deer and elk out of six arc. And it's like, I know you can do it, right?
Yeah.
But like, I don't make that recommendation. Like, I think there's a better solution out there. Right. And so the hard part is like predicting where people are going, or like where the social component is driving people to thinking this is the best solution. And right now I still think we're trending into the small, super efficient format mm-hmm. cases a little bit. And I got to tip my hat to the guys over at Hornady for 6.5 Creedmoor, really pushing us this direction. What I call the Dave Emery School of Ballistic Sciences, where we're making cases intelligently to do the work that they're supposed to do. And the comparison is like 260 Remington, great cartridge. I've had four of them. I don't have anymore. Right. We have a small case that the geometry is such that the bullet can just be the bullet doing bullet things. The case is doing case things. There's not so much of a line crossing or an interaction with them. And I think we're still going that direction. And even 7PRC is actually a really, it's kind of in that camp because it's much less than a Nozzler, excuse me, in dimensions. And more along the lines of something like that more efficient design. But it's still a very powerful cartridge. I don't know though how long that lasts.
Yeah.
You know, with things like Peak Alloy on the horizon, like you guys have the 168 LRX and a Peak Alloy. I was shooting that out of a 16-inch gun the other day. Unreal. Like, I don't know what that means for the industry. Like my personal thoughts are this is the biggest technological breakthrough that we've had in metallic cartridges since we took powder and put it in a case. And like, that's a bold statement, but like 1871 was a 4570 and like, we haven't done much different since then.
Yeah.
And that technology is crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if that means that all of a sudden you start seeing, think of a case dimensionally like a six arc, which I'm a huge fan of. If you took a six arc case and you gave it that Peak Alloy treatment, and then I put a 95 LRX in it, now I have like more than a six Creedmoor based on percentages. I'm getting closer to, dare I say, 240 Weatherby territory potentially. Mm-hmm. And like that rewrites the whole book. Like everything is different then. But I think like to answer that question in a much more palatable format, people are still crazy about BC.
Yep.
And so they want that number bigger. And I don't know that you can necessarily educate enough to change their minds. Mm-hmm. Cause it's not incorrect logic. Like BC is useful to you, mm-hmm. assuming that the rest of the projectile can do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
But I still think they want that. And then I think they want, like, your guys' uphill battle is still dispelling myths about copper bullets.
Yeah.
About fouling and how much fouling they have. Man, I can't tell you how many thousands and thousands of Barnes bullets I have fired in my career. I haven't a clue. And how that has never been an issue for me ever. And then like expansion. And like one of the reasons that we talk about cartridges on our and bullets on our podcast is because just in the chair that we're in and the phone calls that we have, and then these recommendations that we give people for products, I've heard that everybody's bullet from every major manufacturer is either the worst or the best.
Yeah.
And there's no rhyme or reason to it. Like, and the failure modes that I've heard are absurd. And like I've killed 40 plus head of big game with these bullets in 16, 18 years. at distances from 11 yards to 532, from game weights ranging from 35 pounds to 335 pounds. And I've used anemic cartridges on large things and large cartridges on anemic things. And one thing I've never had is a bullet failure of any kind, not even remotely close. Like, everything is explainable when I start looking through that body cavity upon recovery. Everything is explainable. Well, that thing didn't drop in its tracks because the bullet entered behind the diaphragm and all I hit was GI tissue.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. And so I think like the biggest thing, like what people are asking for is like more information, like how these things work and why people like me just gravitate towards them and refuse to even look at anything else. Because I think there's just not a lot of intel out there unless you go shoot a bunch of stuff. And some people are really fortunate and have the ability to do that. Like, we can kill effectively an unlimited number of whitetails every year where I'm from, or people in the South that can kill pigs. You start talking to like African PHs and like the guys that especially Tanzania, Mozambique, places like this where they're killing large bovine, Barnes is at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And then the guys that run top tier Plains Games outfits where they're hunting eland and kudu and oryx and sable and tough critters, Barnes. Mm-hmm. That's what they shoot. And in Europe too, like I've got very good buddies of mine in the UK that are professional deer stalkers, Barnes, because they just kill. And I think they need more information. They need more education on like the terminal performance standpoint and like how the bullets work. A question that I get a lot is how far can I shoot them? Because they hear me talk about function window.
Yeah.
And it's a great question. I always pad the number a little bit. I give them a little insurance policy. I've experienced other things.
Right.
You know, I've taken critters below your guys' published function windows and they were dead. That's not something I necessarily recommend doing unless you are targeting structure or you have a ton of confidence in that, or you've replicated that test a lot of times and you know where it's at. But I think if you can figure out ways to continually improve the profile without sacrificing what people like me have come to love about these projectiles, and that's just reliability.
And
predictability. Predictability is a better word to use for it.
Yeah.
Reliability is the output of predictability. I just know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Because I've had other bullets not do what they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at that. I'm looking at that thoracic cavity and I'm looking at how did that happen? Like, it doesn't make sense. And then the next critter, you know, 2 hours later on the same hunt with the same projectile is a completely different thing. It's like, well, how did that happen?
Yeah.
And like, that just doesn't happen with Barnes projectiles.
Yeah. That's interesting to hear. I mean, I definitely think that's something we endeavor to do, right? Is like, and that's something we haven't done here for years, is like the educational piece.
Yeah.
And so that's,
I mean, I would like to
doubling
think
down
that
on that
as the podcast develops and everything else, right? And as we're putting more and more stuff out there, right? That we're being able to do that. It just, you know, it's like you can only cover so many topics podcasts. So you're just trying to get things rolling.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we'll get there, but I think that's an absolute must and a necessity. And I think that, you know, we've recognized that. So,
I don't think there's like a miss in the bullet line. Like, what don't you have?
Yeah.
You know, you guys still make a 348 bullet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nobody makes 348 bullet.
That's right? Actually, you say that and it just reminded me. So one of our employees here, Bill, as I was walking into work yesterday, grabbed me and he's like, "Hey, check this out." And he'd purchased off eBay this old Barnes ad from way back when. And it was when we just had originals.
Yep.
It was Randy and Connie Brooks owned because it was an American Fork address, but it had to have been early. I couldn't find a date on it, but I'm like, this was early, early Randy Connie Brooks days.
Yeah.
And it was the whole catalog on one page and it had some game animals, but it was neat. It had, you know, order by mail, you know, the part numbers. And I was kind of fun because I looked through what we still offer today and the 348 250 grain original stood out. And I was like, how cool is that?
There has been one cartridge in that bore diameter ever. And it's not even around anymore. You guys still have it. Like, so I think there's holes in the line. And I think it's like very fleshed out and very like it's intelligent. And bullets have come and gone since I've been using your guys' products now. Like there's no XLCs anymore. There's no MRXs and the TSXs have changed. And the addition of the LRXs has been awesome. I'd be curious, like maybe this is an Alan question. How many people call and just say, well, I'm just going to get the LRX because it has the higher BC and like skip over TSX and TTSX. And
we hear it, but it's actually surprising. There's a lot of people using LRXs that even if they're only going to shoot 200-300 yards. Yeah. And I understand, like I pretty much hunt exclusively with LRXs. Yep. I mean, unless I'm using like a lever gun or a muzzleloader, yep, Barnes product. I mean, if I'm in a rifle cartridge, I'm shooting an LRX.
Oh, I just thought of something.
Yeah.
Okay.
But having said that, I think we still get a lot where, like, you know, we bring up some of the misinformation and, mm-hmm, misunderstood. I think a lot of that really is mostly focused on the TSX, mm-hmm, and it's a great bullet, but it was designed for high weight retention, deep penetration, realistically. And there's exceptions, 20 Nosler. We built a 162, mm-hmm, TSX for the 20 Nosler that will function great at 600 yards, but that's the exception. That's the rare. I mean, most of the TSXs are built for 300 yards and in,
mm-hmm,
you know, you're taking a bullet outside of its design parameters and trying, like you said, any so-called failures, it's generally when they're trying to make that bullet do something it was never, mm-hmm, designed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the TSX, it doesn't have a tip. You got to have a tip, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just like the BC number, right? Yep. It like all comes back to, I think, BC, because it's one number that people can at least wrap their head around and compare to other things. Yes. Whether they're comparing apples to apples is a different question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's just a simple number that people don't take into account all the other factors, right? Yeah. That makes BC not the end all be all, but it's like very, very simple.
Yeah. And I think in doing, they put a lot of importance on that number.
Yeah.
They're just like, well, that analog over there is 200 points higher.
Yeah.
Without the understanding that bullet over there, like, don't shoot that at things with a heartbeat.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Cause that's not what it's supposed to do.
It's for paper. Yeah.
Something I thought of, muzzleloaders. Mm-hmm. So muzzleloaders, I love muzzleloading. I've got everything from a 54 caliber round ball gun to a smokeless gun and five others in between. And that technology has peaked. Like we are in the golden era of muzzleloading, and CVA's got a new gun out right now, budget minded. This is an extension of their Paramount that is now smokeless capable out of the box, $1,500.
Okay.
And like, I've got an Arrowhead. I've got serial number 3 off the Arrowhead line. Like that is the premier smokeless gun. And now there's a $1,500 option out there for the consumer. And that is going to change the way, in like a trickle down effect, that the guy or gal who's buying the $350 muzzleloader thinks about muzzleloader projectiles. Cause they're going to see that big, long, racy tip on some of these muzzleloader projectiles and be like, that's what I need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something along those lines. That'd be cool.
Okay. Did you take note of that?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we took note of that a while back.
Yeah. I might. We recently recorded a muzzleloader podcast.
Right.
And we kind of gave a little teasers, but yeah, it's, again, can't say too much, but we're very aware.
Yeah.
And I totally
agree. We're always testing things.
Yeah.
Right.
Always testing things. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
We're always testing things.
Yeah.
But no, muzzleloaders, the Magnum MZ is a great product. That's my go-to. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not shooting the Paramount Remington Ultimate level velocities, standard Magnum guns with 150 grain, you know, 3 pellet type charges, I still say use the Magnum MZ.
Yeah.
I'm that green Sabot, just, it works better at even those velocities versus the blue one and the TEZ.
We found the same too. And really, I think it's more bore condition than it is anything else. Like some of those guns, they're, you can get a lot of, you can get away with a lot when you get over like a 45 caliber bore. Like you can have a really, really poor bore condition and the gun will still shoot really good. But they chew soft sabots like crazy.
Yeah.
And those greens, whatever that material is bulletproof.
Yeah, it does good.
Yeah.
But I totally hear it. I mean, we know, you know, there's guys that want that next level of performance, and you bring up a good point. I was looking at that CVA gun just a week ago.
Yeah.
With that smokeless option now and digging in, but it's.
And I want to transition real quick. I assume we're getting close to kind of wrapping up here, but like, you know, one question selfishly for Barnes, as we, you know, continue this podcast, mm-hmm. we're in like month 3 right? Like, so we're still very, very new. You guys have been extremely successful, right, in your podcast. Like, what advice would you have? What guidance could you give to, like, you know, help broaden our reach or make sure we target all the consumer mm-hmm. wants and needs and the educational piece, right? Like, what advice would you give for us as we continue down our path?
So when I look at the productions that we do that are most successful, none of them are about us. And that's actually a motto that we have at work. It's the inverse of that. It's about you.
Okay.
And so we take that about you statement. And it's like, when you see an inquiry in the comment section, build a podcast around that singular question. Encourage people to ask questions that they haven't been, right? Because they're looking for answers. Mm-hmm. That's why they're consuming this media. And then think outside the box. Like, we sell rifle scopes, binoculars, spotting scopes, range finders, and tripods. And the majority of our podcast is about cartridges or guns, right? And so I think, how do I say this without getting in trouble at work? Bullets are more interesting than optics, I think, to listen to and talk about. And like, I can talk about scopes all day long. I can tell you all sorts of cool things. It's dry. And not that great. So like, you guys got a little advantage there in that, like, bullets to a gun guy, to a shooter, are intimately fascinating. And like, the processes that you have going on here. And as somebody who's been using the Barnes brand for decades, to walk through it and to see it now, and like, I was woefully underprepared for how cool it is. And like, I can't speak highly enough to the process checks that are going on here. And like, that's what builds a really good product, is process checks and consistency, consistency, consistency. And like, you guys are doing NASA level stuff. And I don't think a lot of people know about that. Like, show the world what you can without giving away the recipe for the soup, but and do that kind of thing and just educate. And like, the podcast, and I think you guys are going to find this too. Like, to me, the podcast is as much a product as a pair of Viper 8x42 binoculars, because education is a tangible, mm-hmm. like, and it should, I'm not saying it should have a SKU and a UPC, but, it should be treated as such. Right. And it's a very, very powerful and useful tool. And so to take a lot of those questions that, say, Alan's getting and talk about them.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to solve a lot of people's problems before they have to find out about them as problems, or you're going to answer the question before they have to ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Ryan, I appreciate you taking the time and coming and hanging out.
Yeah.
Look forward to seeing you again at Hunt Expo. That's probably the next time that we'll see each other.
Yep. Probably.
So we'll have to stop by the booth, or you stop by our booth, and I'll be chat
there.
Again.
I'll be there.
All right. Thanks, guys.
See ya.